the four types of metal statue. In chapter 2 and verse 47, the king answered Daniel and said, "Surely your God is a God of gods and a Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, since you have been able to reveal this mystery." So for the first time in the book of Daniel, we have this man Nebuchadnezzar wise enough and humble enough to recognize for face value when he sees the superiority of the God of Daniel and his three friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And so the king answers Daniel, "Your God is a God of gods, number one, Lord of kings." So note that that has to include him now. He's the big soul king over Babylon at the moment, and a revealer of mysteries. And so there's a degree of humility there where he places himself underneath Yahweh. Now, if you'll skip over to the end of chapter 3, that was the end of chapter 2. Last week, as we closed out with chapter 3, we have this in verse 28. Nebuchadnezzar responded and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego," those of course being the Babylonian names that he gave to Daniel's three friends, "who has sent his angel and delivered his servants who put their trust in him." He is recognizing faith, trust, in their God as opposed to his own. So you'll see in verse 29, "Therefore I make a decree that any people, nation, or tongue that speaks anything offensive against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb and their houses reduced to a rubbish heap, inasmuch as there is no other God who is able to deliver in this way." So he is recognizing the authority and the power of God. He is recognizing God's abilities in interpreting these dreams. He is also recognizing God's miraculous power to rescue these men. No other God is able to deliver in this way. And so now we've had two occasions already where Nebuchadnezzar, at least, is able to accept new information, even if it would run contrary to his previous expectations, and is both wise enough and humble enough to accept it and to declare that truth. Chapter 4 starts the same way. "Nebuchadnezzar the king, to all the peoples, nations, and men of every language that live in all the earth, may your peace abound." What language would Nebuchadnezzar be speaking? Aramaic. What language is this chapter written in? Aramaic. What was chapter 3 written in? Aramaic. Chapter 2, starting at verse 4, also in Aramaic. So each time that Nebuchadnezzar and events that are particularly important and have a point of contact with this king and his kingdom, you know, we're in that material now that is also written in their language. And so this speech is originally emanating apparently from his mouth in Aramaic and now being recorded in Aramaic as well. So men of every language that live in all the earth, in verse 1, he recognizes there's a lot of languages out there, now Hebrew of course being one of them, but this is in Aramaic. So in verse 2, here we go. "It has seemed good to me to declare the signs and wonders which the Most High God has done for me. How great are his signs, and how mighty are his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion is from generation to generation." Now please note, we had these preceding declarations from Nebuchadnezzar. Now he's going to start off giving credit and glory and honor to the God of heaven. He's also doing something, mentioning something that has already been mentioned once before. If you'll turn back to chapter 2 again, only this time it's in the midst of Daniel's interpretation at verse 44. "In the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed. And that kingdom will not be left for another people. It will crush and put an end to all these kingdoms, but it will itself endure forever. Now, those words are spoken by Daniel. Those words were given to Daniel as an inspired interpretation of the dream. But essentially, you find those words in the last half of verse 3 in the mouth of an Aramaic-speaking King Nebuchadnezzar when he says his kingdom is an everlasting kingdom and his dominion is from generation to generation. He has now added yet another quality of God that is superior to any other god or any other king, certainly all the magicians and conjurers and the rest of them that had failed him so badly. But now, twice we've been told already in the early going of this book, there's a kingdom coming, and this new kingdom, when it arrives, is everlasting. The dominion isn't left to somebody else. It never goes away. Nebuchadnezzar learned this from Daniel in chapter 2, and it's apparently sticking. So that now, when he wants to tell a personal story, which is rather humiliating, again, demonstrating then some finer qualities in this man, Nebuchadnezzar is speaking in chapter 4. Nebuchadnezzar wanted this in the record. Nebuchadnezzar then finds a ready scribe in Daniel, who now is including this statement in the book. But Nebuchadnezzar got the point of that dream, and apparently he's remembering, he's meditating, he's thinking about what he learned from Daniel in that dream. So now verse 4 as we continue, I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at ease in my house and flourishing in my palace. I saw a dream, and it made me fearful, and fantasies as I lay on my bed, and visions in my mind kept alarming me. So I gave orders to bring into my presence all the wise men of Babylon, that they might make known to me the interpretation of the dream. Then the magicians, the conjurers, the Chaldeans, and the diviners came in, and I related the dream to them, but they could not make its interpretation known to me. But finally, Daniel came in before me, whose name is Belteshazzar, according to the name of my God, and in whom is the spirit of the holy gods, and I related the dream to him, saying, O Belteshazzar, chief of the magicians, since I know that the spirit of the holy gods is in you and no mystery baffles you, tell me the vision of my dream which I have seen along with its interpretation. Does that sound familiar? Well, sure it does. Here's a slide from 2 weeks ago, Daniel chapter 2. None of the magicians were able to tell what the dream was, nor, of course, then could they interpret it. Daniel is able to do both. Nebuchadnezzar remembers this. He's giving Daniel credit for this. He's calling for Daniel to reveal what this new dream means. Now, on the screen I have, I hope, there it comes, the next three verses, 10 through 12, and I've just taken them from the New American Standard, but these were the visions in my mind as I lay on my bed. I was looking, and behold, there was a tree in the midst of the earth, and its height was great. The tree grew large and became strong. So he sees a change taking place in it, and its height reached to the sky. And it was visible to the end of the whole earth. Its foliage was beautiful, its fruit abundant, and in it was food for all. The beasts of the field found shade under it, the birds of the sky dwelt in its branches, and all living creatures fed themselves from it. Now apparently this is not a tree that actually exists on the earth today. It's able to feed, a wide variety, apparently all varieties of animal life. That would not be true, I guess, of virtually any other tree. Certainly in its size and scope and the manner in which it behaves, it is a visionary tree. The one caveat, that I'd offer as you look at this slide, it shows, the planet and then a tree that's, at least as tall as the planet's diameter. I don't know that Nebuchadnezzar had such a conception in his mind what the world would look like, from outer space, like we do, having sent people up there to look back at it. But nonetheless, and by the way, where he lives is really very flat. And so the idea of filling all the earth may have more to do with just, you know, being so gigantic that as far as the eye can see it, you know, it would be very prominent in those circumstances. And we don't know what it looked like. But Daniel is explaining to him that this is like no other tree there ever was. It's gigantic, and it is feeding all these various different kinds of animals, as well as sheltering in its shade. So it was a very busy scene, apparently. Now, 13, I was looking in the visions in my mind as I lay on my bed, and behold, a watcher. Do you have an italicized word that's been added in your text, anybody? It is angelic, okay? That is just taking liberty with the text. Now, I, you know, freely recognize this is some sort of a messenger, so in that sense, it is an angel. But, you know, I wish they hadn't done that. As soon as we say angel in our culture and times, what do people, you know, immediately think of? And so it might be just, you know, a little bit misleading in that sense. What this is a watcher. Yours says a holy one, and in the text there, I don't know Aramaic, and so I, you know, I can't give you an explanation for that. I just looked for a footnote, and I don't have an explanation in the text either. You know, and I've noticed that before, but I've never explored that, and so I'm not sure. Well, I just don't have an answer for you on that. So I have watcher in the New American Standard. What text do you have? King James. Okay. So, you know, I just would have to explore that. I don't have an answer for you on that textual or translation question. Yeah.
So the watcher and the holy one came down from heaven, and it's not italicized.
That's right.
I'm sorry. I see what you're saying. You have both, and I have both. I'm sorry. I just stopped too soon. I thought you were saying it was yet an alternate translation. No, okay. All right, no, it just adds, a watcher, a holy one, descended from heaven. So, obviously it calls to mind the idea of angels and all of that, but it is so totally differently identified. This is a unique kind of a description. This being, this holy one, this separated different one, is a what? A watcher. What does that mean? And I don't have an answer for it. Don't know what anybody else does. This, you know, vision is revealing something to Nebuchadnezzar in terms that are apparently just planted in his mind. So this is a watcher. Now, it isn't explained. So what's the only thing you can do? You know, you look at that and you say, well, okay, so now I have to, what does the word mean? What does that call to mind? What does it call to mind? Bill?
Is it possible it's a guardian angel?
Well, you know, I laugh because any question, almost without exception, that begins with the phrase, is it possible, can be answered how? Well, yeah, okay. But if you ask, is there reason to suggest this, then I'd say no. You know, is it possible? I suppose, but if there's evidence for it, I don't see the evidence for it. Yes?
Well, a watcher is someone who watches.
That's exactly it. That's exactly what I was looking for. But now, if I say the overriding characteristic of this individual is that they are a watcher. Now what does that call to mind, Jimmy?
What are they watching?
What do we associate, you know, with watching? What would you add to that? If somebody is all the time, so much so that it's their defining characteristic, they're a watcher. What do you start thinking in terms of? Give me a couple of different ideas. What kind of people watch?
Lifeguards.
A little louder?
Lifeguards.
Exactly. Guards is one thing. Watchers are posted at every tower, all along the walls of every defensible city, and they are regularly replaced, and you can lose your head if you fall asleep while you're at that post. You are a watcher. So what's your job? Well, it's to watch, but it's to watch as a means of defense. That's one. Give me another one. Bill?
Nebuchadnezzar is referred to as my servant, my God.
Mm-hmm.
And he's being watched. He's unique in the non-Jewish rulers in that period. He's protecting God's people. He's taking care of them, preserving them.
Mm-hmm.
And he's doing a service for God.
All right.
And he's also seeing who God is.
Okay, and again, excellent. And this is what I'm looking for is if you'll stop and think about it, I'll bet we could come up with more than half a dozen ideas that would be associated. For Nebuchadnezzar's sake, when he thinks of himself over his kingdom, what is he? He's the ultimate watcher, isn't he? If he doesn't like what he sees, then what? He changes it. You die, or you build, or you're exiled, or whatever it is, you know, but he's the guy that's in charge. A watcher is also then an enforcer. What are the police always doing? They are watchers. And what are they watching for? Infractions. They're looking for people to make mistakes, you know, or to break the law. And so, yeah, I got to tell you, tonight I ran that red light right there tonight. It was just the most embarrassing moment. I'm coming down the street, and we see Carol standing by the side of the road. And so Donna says, "Do you want to pick up a hitchhiker?" So already, you know, we're close. So I look in the rearview mirror, I look back, and I'm trying to judge, you know, people coming, and I think they're too close, you know, and I'm not going to do that. And so by that time, now I've gotten real close to that intersection. So now instead of looking up at the light, I just looked out at the traffic. There wasn't anybody, you know, all the way to Harlow. So what did I do? You just ran a red light. What? I never saw a red light. Now, had there been a policeman there, he'd have been watching for things, and I'm busted. Okay, a watcher. Now we could go on in that vein, but you know I need to move on. But I want you now to try and think a little bit differently, not about jobs for people that are watchers.
But this watcher seems to be directing events.
A watcher is directing the events. Okay, so what's going on behind the scenes when you're putting on a play? You have a stage manager or director. See, there's always somebody that's in charge, and they are making sure, you know, that the next cue comes up, you know, and you're in your place. I anticipate everything that's going to happen. Outstanding. So let me just add one more. Well, go ahead, Carol. I think you had your hand earlier.
I was just going to say that on the news tonight, they had at a pool, you need to have a designated watcher.
Okay.
Because
Exactly. And it doesn't have to be somebody's lying there on the bottom of the pool, you know. But how many times have you heard the lifeguard say, "Walk, don't run"? They're preventing those kind of problems. Let's just add this one other layer, you know, not, again, a job that you would be doing. But what would happen if somebody is an extremely focused observer? What happens to them? They learn stuff, don't they? They know things. A watcher is also a wise person. When, you know, that one time, it only happens once in a childhood, the parent will say, "Pay attention." You only need to do that once, right? Because kids are ever vigilant, right? No. But that's what you want them to be, is alert and aware at all times. In this manner, they learn. They become wise. And in their wisdom, they're able to predict then, you know, what would be a good choice and what would be a bad choice or a course of action. So So you know, we can speculate on this, but the word is presented apparently so that we will. It's put there, and then it's not explained. But we should focus on it. This individual was a watcher. And the watcher, who is a holy one, set apart then apparently for this job, descended from heaven. He shouted out and spoke as follows. Chop down the tree. Cut off its branches. Strip off its foliage and scatter its fruit. Let the beasts flee from under it and the birds from its branches. Yet leave the stump with its roots in the ground. But with a band of iron and bronze around it. You know, I never thought about this. It's amazing to me always how often you can read passages and you don't see something, and then you just need somebody else, you know, to be looking at it and give you the idea. How many years have I been reading Daniel 9:15? And lo and behold, not once in my whole life did I ever see two bands on the tree. One of iron and one of bronze. It says, but with a band of iron and bronze. Somehow, like the statue in Daniel 2, I was thinking of it as being some sort of amalgamation of the two, you know, some composite of the two. But I did find a picture, I didn't put it up here, but, you know, found this one picture. It had one of iron and one of bronze. Well, why not? And so the language would permit it. I don't know if there are two bands or somehow these, you know, there's an alloy here. But here's this band. And then continuing, in the new grass of the field, and let him be, notice it switches to him, be drenched with the dew of heaven, and let him share with the beasts and the grass of the earth. Let his mind be changed from a man, and let a beast's mind be given to him. And let seven periods of time pass over him. This sentence is by the decree of the... Now it's plural. So apparently there's a group up in heaven because he descended from heaven. There is this some group that are called watchers. Now, there's a number of things that we find in heaven. You know, there are, we say, just angels, and then there are the seraphim. I am, as always, means what? Seraphim means plural. I am is their S. Seraphim. Okay? Cherubim is what? More than one cherub. Okay, then we've got other beings that are described in fantastical ways. Never forget that up there, there are also what? Watchers. Here are the watchers. So, one has come down with a decree from these watchers, a sentence that has come from the watchers. And the decision is a command of the holy ones in order that the living may know that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whom he wishes and sets over it the lowliest of men. Now, brethren, just for a moment, stop and think. What could Nebuchadnezzar get out of that without any interpretation whatsoever? Do you need an interpretation of what verse 17 is intending to convey? No. And why? Because 17 tells you what this is intending to convey. It is the interpretation. So this sentence is by the decree of the watchers, and the decision is the command of the holy ones in order. Now I'm being told that the living may know that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whomever he wishes and sets over it the what? Yeah, now, brethren, I would suggest that if you're Nebuchadnezzar, there's a lot of this that you don't understand. You may not get what that tree is. You may not understand why it's cut down. You don't know what the band of iron is or the band of bronze or if there's only one band and how, you know, you may not understand a lot about this. But do you understand verse 17, that the living are supposed to know something. Is Nebuchadnezzar a living man? Well, sure. The Most High, who's that? Nebuchadnezzar knows who the Most High is. He's referred to Yahweh as the Most High God. We read it tonight. The Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind. Does he not know what mankind is? Does he not know what a ruler is? And bestows it on whom he wishes. You don't get to be a ruler unless God gives you the power and sets over it the what? The lowliest of men. Now, we're going to learn in short order, you've known for many, many years, does Nebuchadnezzar, you know, consider himself to be one of the lowliest of men? The trouble he's about to get into is precisely because he does not think of himself that way. But could he understand the concept that inferior people might be rulers? Where might he have gotten that idea? In Daniel chapter 2. He was the head of what? And after you, successive kingdoms, and what was he told about the kings of those kingdoms? They were inferior. That's a word that's used. As well as the value that you have in those minerals, the gems, you know, the commodities that are in the statue. So, brethren, what I'm suggesting here is that Nebuchadnezzar isn't entirely in the dark. 17 is perfectly comprehensible. It's the earlier going that's the problem. So now, though, in 18, this is the dream which I, King Nebuchadnezzar, have seen. In this case, he was willing to reveal the dream. Now you, Belteshazzar, tell me its interpretation, inasmuch as none of the wise men of my kingdom is able to make known to me the interpretation. But you are able, for a spirit of the holy gods is in you. Now, brethren, in 18, is it at least possible and seems suggested that Daniel is not the first guy that Nebuchadnezzar called? It looks like he's already called, you know, these other men first. And so, by the way, did apparently all those guys get killed earlier because couldn't tell him what the dream was? No, Daniel did, and apparently in so doing has spared their lives. They're still there in some kind of capacity. And so Daniel is recognized as chief, but apparently Nebuchadnezzar doesn't go to the top, you know, right at the outset. He's apparently started with these other guys. So now, in verse 19, then Daniel, whose name is Belteshazzar, was appalled for a while as his thoughts alarmed him. The king responded and said, Belteshazzar, do not let the dream or its interpretation alarm you. Belteshazzar answered and said, my lord, the dream applied to those who hate you, and its interpretation to your adversaries. Now, likely you'll also have some italicized words there. And in this case, I suppose it might help. It might be just, you know, really worse. It is a colloquial expression that is hard for us maybe to grasp at the beginning. But in my text, they had, my lord, if only the dream applied to those who hate you. Well, that's really not the idea, I don't think, in the original text, you know, there at all. And they supplied those two words, if only. You know, so they leave the idea that what Daniel said was, I wish this applied to somebody, you know, other than you. I wish it applied to your enemies. But what he actually said was, this applies to your enemies, meaning your enemies are the ones that would benefit from this because you're going to fall. He understands, before he tells Nebuchadnezzar, this is all bad news for Nebuchadnezzar, and he's going to lose his sovereign power. He's going to lose his reigning power. So it would apply then, that is, it would be beneficial to the people that would be his enemies. That's certainly the idea there, and not, you know, that he was wishing it on somebody else. Now, 20, the tree that you saw, which became large and grew strong, so it was changing before his eyes in the dream, whose height reached to the sky and was visible to all the earth, whose foliage was beautiful and its fruit abundant, and in which was food for all, under which the beasts of the field dwelt, and in whose branches the birds of the sky lodged, it is you, O king, for you have become great and grown strong. and your majesty has become great and reached to the sky, and your dominion to the end of the earth. And in that the king saw a watcher, a holy one, descending from heaven and saying, chop down the tree and destroy it, yet leave the stump with its roots in the ground, but with a band of iron and bronze in the new grass of the field. Remember, that really could go either way in the original. And let him be drenched with the dew of heaven. Let him share with the beasts of the field until seven periods of time pass over him. This is the interpretation, okay. Now, often in Scripture, it also befuddles us that they say this is the interpretation, and what they mean is what follows and not what preceded. We usually do it the other way around. But here, I'm going to tell you what it is in 24. This is the interpretation, O king. This is the decree of the Most High which has come upon my lord the king. So, at the end of verse 24, I have a colon in my text. This, now we need the colon because it's what follows. 25. That you be driven away from mankind, and your dwelling place be with the beasts of the field, and you be given grass to eat like cattle, and be drenched with the dew of heaven. And seven periods of time will pass over you until you recognize that the Most High, there's only one of those, and everybody knows who that is in this story, the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whomever he wishes. And then, judging by, you know, the interpretation and what we have in the rest of this chapter, who then is this lowliest of men who got such power? Well, it's going to be Nebuchadnezzar. He's the guy. So, 26. In that it was commanded to leave the stump with the roots of the tree, your kingdom will be assured to you after you recognize that heaven rules. Therefore, O king, may my advice be pleasing to you. Break away now from your sins by righteousness, and from your iniquities by showing mercy to the poor, in case there may be a prolonging of your prosperity. So Daniel very simply interprets the dream. You're the guy, and you're going to get chopped down. You are not going to be influential over all the earth. Seven unknown periods of time, which most people take to be years, and maybe they were, but it's not defined. Could be months, could be weeks, don't know. But seven periods of time, however long those times were, going to pass over you, and you're going to eat grass. And it'll be given to you to eat grass. So, you're going to learn. Heaven rules. Isn't that exactly what verse 17 said? Sure it is. So there's no difference in the interpretation at verse 26 than there was back in 17. But there is in Daniel the urgent request that Nebuchadnezzar do what, in a single word that starts with R and ends with intent. He become repentant. And he repent. He likes Nebuchadnezzar. He wants Nebuchadnezzar to do better. He would have him avoid this punishment. Now whether or not Daniel knows how long it'll be before this punishment is executed, we're not told. But he does assume that Nebuchadnezzar at least would have time enough that he ought to try. So, please do this. Well, in 28, all this happened to Nebuchadnezzar the king. 12 months later, he was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon. So it's a year goes by. Now, if you didn't notice, I did change the slide, and for the next little bit, I would like to show you a series of slides. I was able to find what I thought were really excellent artist's illustrations of what Babylon may have looked like. But before I show you those, let's read a little bit further here. So in 12 months later, walking on the roof of the royal palace, the king reflected and said, is this not Babylon what? Babylon the Great, which I myself have built as a royal residence by the might of my power and for the glory of my majesty. Now, brothers, is this Babylon the Great? Yeah, it is. And at that point, I don't think there's anything wrong with calling it Babylon the Great, which I myself have built. True or false? Well, really, yeah, true. But it's when he gets to, by the might of my power and for the glory of my majesty. Looks to me like that's probably where he actually stepped over the line. Now, he could have called it Babylon the Great, and he could have said, I built it myself. But I built it because of God's power and because and to the glory of his majesty. He could have done the first two, you know, in truth, and not been in trouble, I think, if he'd understood to whom to attribute his power. But he didn't do it. So then, while the word was in the king's mouth, a voice came from heaven saying, King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is declared, sovereignty has been removed from you. So now for a moment, just, you know, have a look at this artist's conception. Here is the river Euphrates. They just used what archaeological evidence we have, what historical records we have, to then fancifully imagine what Babylon may have looked like. Now, let me give you a couple of facts about this town, though. Number one, the outer wall of Babylon is thought to be perhaps a 10-mile perimeter. 10 miles. That's a lot of wall for a city in those days. In this Google Earth search, you all recognize this perimeter right here, don't you? Interstate 5, here's the Beltline, Delta Highway, I know, 126. This area, it happens, is just almost precisely that 10-mile perimeter that you're talking about right there, real close. So, just a little bit wider, you know, it's not square, and we're not told his city was anyway, so, you know, it's just the perimeter we're talking about. So you say, well, okay, that's an area we can conceptualize very well. We've all driven it, we've all lived in it, you can all understand that. Here's fact number two for you to think about, where all those freeways are. The inner wall and towers were perhaps 90 feet tall on an inner wall. The outer wall is 10 miles in circumference, and then there's another wall, apparently 9.5, set inside, and it has towers at regular intervals that in the wall itself may have been 90 feet high. 90 feet is 9 stories. Now try to just imagine all that freeway has a structure on it that's 9 stories tall. Would that be fairly impressive? That'd be fairly impressive. One side of the city ran along the edge of the Euphrates River, which at that point actually runs pretty deep and wide and fast. So there was a bridge they mentioned across it that also was pretty spectacular, you know, in its own right. That eventually that will be, the Euphrates will be the weak part of the city. But you've all heard about the Hanging Gardens, and nobody knows exactly what they were like, but they've been listed as one of the 7 wonders of the world. And so there was apparently a magnificent amount of foliage. And that somehow it had been designed so that water was pumped or carried somehow, you know, up from the Euphrates and watered this city and especially the palace and likely the temples in such a manner that there's foliage, you know, hanging down on all sides. It's breathtaking. It's one of the 7 wonders of the world. Nebuchadnezzar's throne, they have determined, was 150 feet long and 45 feet wide. Or vice versa. I'm not sure which way he sat. Is that bigger than this building? Yeah. Considerably. Okay? And that's just the throne room that we're talking about. So, there were temples throughout the city. Marduk is the chief god. And for that chief god Marduk, approaching what was a vast area that was used in his worship, there was a 72-foot-wide processional road that led up to the entrance to that temple. 72 feet wide. both sides have bricks, have a wall on either side with bricks that are glazed in blue and are adorned with lions. So here's an artist's reconstruction of what that approach may have looked like, leading to this gate, which is called the Ishtar Gate, as you go into the temple complex for Marduk. Now, in Berlin's museum, there is this reconstruction that is using original materials. In Berlin's museum, you can see people standing in front of this thing that has been rebuilt. That's called the Ishtar Gate. Is that thing pretty impressive? Well, I guess. And that would be, what is it? What is the most spectacular and awesome part of our whole building? I think it's the door. What would you call the best thing we got? You don't think the door. Oh, you're going to have a temple and you got a wall around it. The gate is just a door to go into the temple. What would the temple look like? Well, apparently what he had devoted to Marduk would just dwarf what we're looking at here. That's just mind-boggling. So here is another artist reconstruction, but they know about this blue glaze, of course. You've been looking at it. And so here's another one trying to imagine perhaps the palace, you know, and the hanging gardens. Notice all these waterfalls. So the reports, you know, that we have, the evidence that we have suggests that there's flowing water throughout, you know, all of this and cascading down, watering, you know, all of the city. Just an awesome thing. So, brethren, can you really blame him? You say, look what I did. Look what I did. Now, what's the answer to that question? Yeah, you can blame him. Because God did that he's going to be reduced to something like this because of it. So I can understand it. There was a lot of wisdom. There was a lot of money. There was a lot of power. It's very impressive what Nebuchadnezzar did. But he did not understand who rules. Who rules? The Most High God. Who gave him his every talent? The Most High God. Who can take it away? The Most High God. So, in 31... while the word was in the king's mouth, a voice came from heaven saying, King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is declared, sovereignty has been removed from you. You will be driven away from mankind. Your dwelling place will be with the beasts of the field. You'll be given grass to eat like cattle, and 7 periods of time will pass over you until you recognize that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whomever he wishes. Immediately, the word concerning Nebuchadnezzar was fulfilled. He was driven away from mankind, began eating grass like cattle. His body was drenched with the dew of heaven until his hair had grown like eagles and his nails like birds. So again, they've added feathers and claws, but it just says, you know, hair grew like eagles. Well, you all know what an eagle looks like and they don't have hair. His nails like birds. So, it got so, just unkept that it was unnatural and disgusting and beastly. 34. But at the end of that period, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes toward heaven, and my reason returned to me, and I blessed the Most High. Is that Marduk? No, decidedly not. And praised and honored him who what? Lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom endures from generation to generation. That's the third time we've been told that in Daniel's book. The eternal nature of a coming kingdom, which is the fifth kingdom, in the days of those kings of the statue in Daniel 2, which means in the days of the Roman kings there at the end. So, he gets it. Now, for just a moment, everybody's curious, and again, we're not told about it. In this case, we don't have a historical record we can turn to. But in 33, He was driven away from mankind. Now, this suggests a couple of things. Number one, that he had become beastly, that he had lost his mind, that you couldn't just ask him to leave a room. You couldn't just ask him if it's time for a haircut or would he comb his hair. You couldn't do that anymore. So now that he was out of his mind, what were you going to have to do if you needed to move him from one place to another? You had to make it by force. You had to drive him like you would cattle. So he loses his mind and he becomes apparently unruly, unresponsive. He must be driven. He has to be driven away from mankind, perhaps because, like animals, he's become dangerous to other human beings. But we don't know why. We don't understand any more than what's told here. But he was driven away from mankind. They felt it necessary to do that. And he began eating grass like cattle. Now notice before, twice we've been told, grass will be given to him. Now for just a moment, you know, I've thought about this, and most people have, you know, why in the world, you know, eating grass, why would you give him grass? Brethren, if any one of your family members lost their mind, would you give them grass? Doesn't that just make no sense whatsoever? The only thing that I can imagine here is this. If you have somebody go insane, you have to force them away from others. So somehow, you know, you've removed them, and likely then there would be shelter, but also an outdoor area. If you're going to be at all kind, you know, then you don't put him in solitary confinement. You'd have a yard of some kind. There'd be a way to provide for him both indoor and outdoor. I mean, we'd do this for a gorilla. And so I'm thinking it was like that. Now you bring food. You bring the choicest and best food there is. And if they won't eat, then what? Well, if you notice that they eat grass, and it's the only thing they eat, then before too long, what would you start doing? You'd be giving them choice grass. And so it all makes perfect sense if we just think, how did he get into this circumstance? So he's driven away from mankind. That doesn't mean he was wandering loose in the woods. He began eating grass like cattle. His body was drenched with the dew of heaven. Well, apparently, he just wouldn't come in. And then, until his hair had grown like eagles and his nails like birds. So it got bad, but that does not mean by any means that he was lost out in a forest somewhere, which is the way so often, you know, people, you know, seem to conceive of this. At the end of that period, he raised his eyes, his reason returned, he blessed the Most High. In 35, which we haven't read yet, all the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing, but he, speaking of the Most High, Yahweh, does according to his will in the host of heaven. And among the inhabitants of earth, and no one can ward off his hand or say to him, what have you done? One can question what he does. At that time, my reason returned to me, and my majesty and splendor were restored to me, for the glory of my kingdom, and my counselors and my nobles began seeking me out. So I was reestablished in my sovereignty, and surpassing greatness was added to me. That does not mean that they went hunting for him in the woods. He was readily available. He was still king. Was he still alive? Sure. But he couldn't function. And then suddenly what happened? It all came back. In the minute that it did, what did all the counselors do? You're in charge. Okay? So was this 7 years? I don't know. Now, it would certainly fit this physical description, but so in a shorter length of time, I suppose. And after 7 years, you know, one would begin to wonder how he even survived it or why anybody would then resort to him again. I don't mean to question the years thing. It's just to say that we don't know how long the period of time was. But when it was finished, they had not written him totally off. They had not, you know, exiled him. He was right there, they knew it, and they immediately put the crown back on his head. So, in 37, now, I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise, exalt, and honor the King of Heaven. Is that Marduk? No. For all his works are true, and his ways just, and he is able to humble those who walk in pride. You gotta love Nebuchadnezzar, don't you? Because that guy could learn his lesson. This is a really harsh one. But the first couple weren't so harsh at all. Fiery furnace. He gets it. Interpreted dream. He gets it. This is a harsh judgment. Punishment for the way you've behaved. But three occasions now, what does he do? He immediately gives the glory and the honor to God in a humble and what is becoming now a very sophisticated and lengthy list of attributes that he ascribes to the God of heaven, like truth and justice in this last sentence. This is very impressive. Nebuchadnezzar was a man who made mistakes, as all men do. I've heard women do that on occasion even. But this guy, what's he do? He learns his lessons, and he properly responds. So now, brethren, what I've done in my Bible, and I give this as an assignment for you, tonight or, you know, next few days, whatever, but when you go home, go back to chapter 2 at the end, and then read through 2, 3, and 4, and highlight. I use yellow just to highlight the eternal kingdom. And then I use green to highlight all those places where Nebuchadnezzar gives glory and honor and praise to Yahweh our God. And then make a list, if you will, or at least just stop and take notice if you don't actually write it down, what he understands about the character and power of God. It's a great list. A wise man who is learning his lesson. He is a tool, an instrument in the hand of God. Now, Daniel already knows about Jeremiah. We skipped Jeremiah in our Wednesday night classes, but Jeremiah is in between. And Daniel's got his book that he's reading when he's in captivity there. And so Daniel knows the end from the beginning, but Daniel is a high court official. Might he have been giving some of Jeremiah's information to Nebuchadnezzar? Certainly, he might have. And we saw in our introductory class that in Jeremiah, Jeremiah told the people, surrender, go into exile, and recognize that God is rescuing you from death. He is protecting you while you're in Babylonian captivity. And who was the rescuer and the protector according to Jeremiah? Nebuchadnezzar, who came into town three times before he destroyed the temple in Jerusalem. And so this is a marvelous character who is mentioned by name and described at length a great deal more than virtually, you know, well, than any other Gentile king, and far more than most of the Jews' kings. An impressive guy who was being used by God for a very specific reason, and understood his place, in this case, the hard way. Thank you. And class dismissed.